My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hi everybody, welcome to another edition of My Classic Album. As always, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris. Maybe a bit of a surprise that we're a little early. I've been saying the 1st of August for this episode for a while. You know, obviously we plan these quite far ahead of time. A great episode for you today. And then I realised that on the 31st of July and the 1st of August, I was going to be in the middle of nowhere. Going to be in a lovely caravan in a place called Allenby in Cumbria. People in the UK probably know where that is. And it just dawned on me that I wouldn't be able to upload the episode. So it was either a case of upload it later or upload it earlier. And I thought, why not? Let's get it online now. You know, it's a great episode. I want people to get excited about it as possible. And July's been an awesome month for the podcast. So why not technically throw a third episode in there towards the end of July? So, so excited for today's episode. Emily Johansson, drummer from a fantastic Swedish band, Thundermother, is joining me on the show to talk about an album by one of my favourite bands of all time, Iron Maiden's Power Slave album. It's a great combination. Thundermother, Iron Maiden. Oh, yeah, it's so exciting. Really looking forward to you all hearing it. And the perfect time, really, to get stuck into Iron Maiden with the release of their new album in September, Senjutsu. Very, very excited for that. I think the video, and again, Iron Maiden fans will be aware of this, they premiered the video for the new song, Writing on the Wall, to much kind of cryptic fanfare. And I think I was kind of sat on my phone waiting for the YouTube video to start and just blown away by the music video. I really like the song, maybe something a bit different from Iron Maiden than we've come to expect over the years. And yeah, I think it's great. And it was the perfect time because I knew that our next episode, of course, was going to be about Power Slave. So while we're all getting excited for a new Iron Maiden album, what better time to go back in and discuss one of the true classic Iron Maiden albums in Power Slave, an awesome choice by Emily. And sometimes these things just happen, so that's just happened by pure happenstance. I interviewed Emily back in June, I think it was, so there was no kind of inclination that Maiden were going to be doing this. So, you know, so much fun. Really excited for you all to hear my chat with her. Really excited to, of course, hear the new Iron Maiden album in September too, and I'm sure I'll be sharing my opinions about that all over social media as well. So, you know, if you've got that Iron Maiden bug, because, you know, there's that activity, they're getting excited, they're getting stuck into things, same here, absolutely same here. So really excited to hear all of that. So hopefully we can whet your appetite a little bit over the next hour or so talking about Power Slave. We'll be playing a track from Thundermother 2, who, you know, if you're an Iron Maiden fan and you haven't heard of Thundermother, I think you will really enjoy them. Great band. You know, so pleased we'll finally be able to get a member of Thundermother on the show. But we've got some fantastic episodes coming up over the next couple of months. And I always say this because I like to be a month or two ahead. I like to know who's coming up and what albums are coming up. And yeah, I mean, I think this year particularly, things seem to have really kind of skyrocketed. Been getting some amazing guests, picking some phenomenal albums. We've just come off the back of Phil Collin from Def Leppard talking about David Bowie's Aladdin Sane. One of my favourite episodes we ever did. The conversation that we had was just really fascinating around, you know, it wasn't just about Bowie, was it? It was about all kinds of things. So it was really an absolute thrill for me to talk to Phil Collin, the guitarist of one of my favourite bands of all time. So, you know, that episode was our previous My Classic Album episode. Feel free to get yourself back to that. Bit of a change in pace compared to those. We had Jonathan Antoine this time last month talking about Jeff Buckley's fantastic album Grace. And I know that was a really popular episode. I've got a feeling we'll be seeing Jonathan again in the future because I think people got really excited, not only for Jonathan's appearance on the show, but his choice as well. It's easily going to be one of our most listened to episodes when it's all said and done. Just the downloads and the chart appearances and streams and everything we've had for that episode have been phenomenal. So that, next to Phil from Def Leppard, July's been a bit of a banner month for My Classic Album, and hopefully it'll continue. In a couple of weeks' time, we'll be chatting with Ron Bumblefoot Thal, which, again, another guitar hero of mine. That's just, it's crazy to think that Ron's coming on the show. He's chatting about the 1977 album Going for the One by Yes. Again, if you like your progressive rock, a great episode to tune into. You know, so much fun to chat with Ron about that album. And I'd not listened to Yes for a long time, so again, it was nice to kind of dive back into that world, I guess. And I don't think we do enough progressive rock on My Classic Album sometimes, so it's good to do that. And what we're also going to be doing, or I should say what I'm also going to be doing on the show, which I think is going to be, I haven't decided whether, I was going to say a lot of fun, I can't decide whether it's going to be quite frank. So Bumblefoot's very well known for his range of hot sauces. So when I'm recording the links for that episode, you'll be able to see this live on Instagram Live. So if you follow us on Instagram, if you've got it, at My Classic Album Podcast, somewhere between now and the 15th of August, I'll be recording the links, naturally, for this episode. And when I do, I shall be sampling some of his fantastic, the fifth hottest hot sauce in the world, from what I've read, Bumblefucked. So I'm going to try some of that and then try and get through my links. We'll see how that goes. I think that'll be a bit of fun. But then at the beginning of September's going to be another great month. So we've got Reva Taylor coming on the show to chat about Annie Lennox's Diva. Annie Lennox, and I feel like just lately I'm saying this about every single artist or album that we cover, but genuinely, Annie Lennox is one of my favourite female vocalists of all time. You know, I love her solo work. Eurythmics is fantastic, but it's her solo stuff that gets me really excited. And so to talk about Diva, which has tracks like Why and Walking on Broken Glass and Little Bird, yeah, it's a great album and a great conversation with Reva about it. And anyone who listened to our previous episode of My Classic Album will have had a preview of not only today's episode, but those other two that I've just discussed. However, we've also got a great, great episode coming up at the end of September. You know I love a good anniversary episode. So far, in the 50-odd episodes we've done of My Classic Album, we've only done this four times previously, where we celebrate the anniversary of one of the true classic albums. And I mean, these all are, but you know, the ones that perhaps are the most commercially, critically successful, you know, the big hitters, the big sellers. And so we've done, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, Meatloaf's Battle of Hell, Def Leppard's Hysteria, Queen and Night at the Opera. So these really big heavyweight classic albums. And there's an album coming up in September that is hitting its 30th anniversary. And that album is Nevermind by Nirvana. So it seemed like the perfect opportunity. We've already done Bleach, which I think we did a couple of years ago. Perfect opportunity to celebrate 30 years of Nevermind. A very good friend of mine, not just from the show, but obviously he has appeared on the show in the past, but someone I've known for a long time, Nathan Stevens Griffin from Martha and One Night Stand in North Dakota, will be joining me to chat all about Nevermind and the impact that it had on him. Funnily enough, probably when we were at school together, you know, I kind of saw a lot of this kind of unfolding in front of my eyes, the impact that Nirvana had on Nathan. And obviously then see his journey into becoming a really successful recording artist is really exciting. So me and Nathan, that's a conversation not to be missed. And obviously with the anniversary episodes, we always do these really cool kind of things, like check in like your favourite tracks and your memories of the album and all this kind of cool stuff that we like to do on the anniversary episodes. Anyone who's a fan of Nathan, or perhaps, you know, wants the appetite wet in terms of our dynamic, if you like, get yourself all the way back to episode 6. So we talked about The Queen is Dead by The Smiths. And as I've said, I've known Nathan for a long time. You know, I think we must have been about 13 when we met in secondary school. So yeah, we're very good friends, you know, known each other over half of my life, certainly. So that opportunity to be able to catch up with him was lovely at the time. And, you know, with things like COVID and families and busy lives, we've not had many opportunities after that. So I know that getting that opportunity to sit down with Nathan is going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to be talking about a hell of an album as well. So that's going to be on the 15th of September to coincide with Nevermind's 30th anniversary later in the month. So some great episodes coming. So obviously Going for the One with Ron Thal on the 15th of August, Diva with Reva Taylor on the 1st of September, and then 30 Years of Nevermind with Nathan and myself, and hopefully a couple of other surprises thrown in there, ideally, on the 15th of September. So great stuff to look forward to on My Classic Album over the next few weeks. But I always get ahead of myself. Let's bring ourselves back to today. Today's classic album is the phenomenal Power Slave by Iron Maiden. For me, it's always a toss-up because I love Number of the Beast. I love Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. Power Slave as well. You know, these three albums, it's really difficult for me to kind of pull one ahead of the other. That early 80s Maiden, well, the whole of the 80s, that 80s Maiden journey is just amazing. So my special guest to kind of talk all about this amazing album in Power Slave is Emily Hansen, drummer from Thundermother. Before we get to my chat with Emily, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Power Slave.
The 3rd of September 1984 marked the release of Power Slave, the fifth studio album from British metal icons Iron Maiden. Fresh off the momentum of 1983's Peace of Mind, Maiden reconvened with producer Martin Birch at Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas to record the follow-up. After a revolving lineup for much of their existence, Power Slave marked the first Iron Maiden album with the same lineup as its predecessor. Ode to Doomsday, 2 Minutes to Midnight was chosen as the first single from the album. It reached number 11 on the UK Singles Chart and number 25 on the Billboard Top Album Tracks Chart. 2 Minutes to Midnight became a mainstay anthem for Iron Maiden, as did second single Aces High, which just made the top 20 in the UK and opened many Iron Maiden live shows for years to come. Power Slave just missed out on the top spot on the UK album charts, being held off by the first ever Now That's What I Call Music compilation. Power Slave also reached number 12 on the US Billboard 200. Its commercial success was enough to earn it platinum certification on both sides of the Atlantic. Amongst a phenomenal run of albums in the 1980s, Power Slave is regarded as a high point, if not the pinnacle, of Iron Maiden's career. German publication Rock Hard placed the album number 29 in its top 300 albums in 2001, while Loudwire named Power Slave 24th in its top 80 hard rock and metal albums of the 1980s in 2016.
So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Power Slave, and I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today on My Classic Album from Thundermother. This is Emily Hansen. How's it going?
Hey, how are everybody? I'm good. It's really sunny, beautiful in Sweden today, so I've had like a wonderful day in the sun, taking a swim in a lake and, you know, stuff like that. So I'm happy. How are you?
I'm great. And you absolutely, you know, again, absolutely it is. It's gorgeous over here as well. Gorgeous weather in the UK. Why have you chosen Power Slave to talk about on My Classic Album today?
When I got the interview and everything, and my manager said, you have to pick one album. I was like, are you kidding me? That's impossible. You know, that's the question you're always like, you know, it's so hard. And then I thought about, like, for me, it was obvious to choose Maiden because they have been, like, my favorite band since I was, like, 15. And even though I listen to a lot of other bands, and for periods I don't listen to Maiden at all, but they just mean so much to me, and they will always do, because, you know, when you're 15 and you're discovering your new big band, you know, that you really like, stuff happens in that age, you know, so they mean a lot to me. So the question was, what made an album? Were we going to talk about, you know? Power Slave was the first one I thought about, so maybe it wasn't a hard choice after all.
Yeah, and I think the reason why, particularly with Maiden albums, is such a hard choice is through the 80s, they just had this amazing run of albums, you know what I mean? And you said it was the first one that popped into your head. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it stands out amongst things like Number of the Beast or Seventh Son of a Seventh Son?
Well, for me, it's one song, Aces High, because that was the one song that got me into Iron Maiden. And it's actually a funny story. No, not super funny, but I was joining my dad to his work because I had a friend in the same town he was working in. And so that's how I got a ride to my friend. But he started to work like 7 in the morning, so I had to hang out on his job for a while just to wait for my friend to wake up because it was a Saturday. And so my dad put his like colleague's computer on and he was like, just paint or something while you wait, you know. And that colleague, he had like, you know, Winamp, that old MP3 player.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, music. So I opened it up and he had one song in there, and that was Aces High with Iron Maiden. And so I put it on, and you know that moment when your brain just, when you know, when a song just blows your mind. That was that kind of moment, you know. It was the best song I had ever heard in my life. And I just listened to it like over and over again. And I had this MP3 player, but I didn't have my USB cable to it. But I had a record button on it, so I could record like in some kind of small microphone there. So I recorded the song through the microphone on my MP3 player just to have it, you know. That was my way into Iron Maiden. So I guess Powerslave was one of the first album I listened to because of that song. And then, of course, I came to love many of the songs on the album after.
And I think, you know, those early Maiden albums, as well as being this real high point for metal, they're kind of defined by this almost this revolving door of members. So those first five albums, it's kind of different members coming in and out. And it's Powerslave's actually, it's the first Iron Maiden album that features the same lineup as its predecessor. Do you think that comes through on the album? So now you've got that knowledge of kind of early Maiden. Do you think it's clear this is a band that they've had a chance to gel as a unit rather than adapting to someone new coming in?
I mean, yeah, for me, they are like the main band members, the ones on that album. But also I do love Clive Burr as a drummer a lot. But I mean, from Number of the Beast, when Bruce joined the band, I mean, a lot happened then. Definitely. And that's the Maiden I love, basically, with Bruce's voice on it.
So I know, obviously, this now quite a stable lineup of Iron Maiden. They came straight off the road from the World Peace Tour in December 83 and immediately started pre-production for Powerslave. So bassist and founder of the band, Steve Harris, told Metal Hammer, he said, "We'd done a world tour to bed Nico into the band. Obviously, the bass player has to work very well with the drummer, so maybe it did create some more confidence." The World Peace Tour, it was also the first tour where Maiden headlined arenas in the US. When he's talking about that creating some confidence, do you hear that in the songs on Powerslave? Do you hear kind of a confidence from Iron Maiden kind of coming through the album?
I mean, I can definitely hear that the band has matured a bit, you know, like on Peace of Mind, the previous album, there's kind of deeper songs on Powerslave, if you know what I mean. And it's when you see the songwriting thing also, you can see a lot more like Bruce Dickinson and Adrian Smith are writing songs together. So yeah, I definitely think that it does something to a band to actually have this comfort with each other and a stable lineup. Definitely.
So, I mean, being a drummer yourself, you've talked a bit, obviously, that you are a fan of Clive Burr on drums. What kind of impact and influence has Nicol McBrain had on you as a drummer, particularly, obviously, choosing Powerslave as your classic album and the effect that Aces High had on you from that first listen?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm a guitarist from the beginning. So when I was 15 and discovered Iron Maiden, I was a full-on guitarist. So for me, it's actually a lot about guitars, and when I listen to the album today, it's still a lot about guitars. And when I started to play drums, I'm more into, you know, John Bonham and, you know, groovy stuff. And I mean, I think Nico is great, and also Clive. I mean, they're both great drummers, and it's very advanced and complicated drumming and super nice, but it has never really been my style. And I always thought, you know, that I'm influenced on guitar from Iron Maiden, but not on the drums. But actually, like recently, I just realized that I have so much Nico McBrain in my drumming. If I, you know, think about it, when I think about it, like in my feels and also, you know, the stage performance, because I'm always kind of smiling when I play. And then when I recently watched a Maiden live show, I was like, okay, Nico McBrain is doing that thing too. So that's where I got that from, you know. So he has influenced me more than I know, you know, more than I realize. And that's actually really cool, because that goes deep, you know what I mean? When I haven't even, you know, put energy into being like him, but he somehow stuff from him comes out of me anyway, you know. I would love to meet him and thank him for everything, you know, all the inspiration and stuff. And he seems like a really cool guy. And I really like that, you know, because when you just hear a Maiden song and you hear the drums, it's really like, you know, aggressive and punchy. And then when you see him, he looks like the friendliest dude on earth. And I think that's cool. I think it's cool and tough to be nice, you know?
Definitely.
You don't have to be angry and look dangerous all the time to be awesome, you know.
And I mean, Ultimate Classic Rock, they note, and this is kind of a quote from them, they said, such an unfamiliar taste for stability in terms of the lineup undoubtedly helped to focus Iron Maiden's creative process, took their mutual instrumental affinity to the next level. The songs on Power Slave span the length and breadth of the group's ability and imagination, alternating captivating bursts of concise metal power with extended progressive experiments in equal measure. And I know you've talked a bit already, you feel like there's a bit of a maturity comes through on Power Slave compared to those earlier albums. In what way does that kind of present itself? In what way do you think this album's a more mature album, perhaps?
I think sound-wise, definitely, because I think that the sound is, it's hard to describe now. All the albums sounds like Maiden, but you know, there's more like fine end to it, if you know what I mean. Like the songs are more like playing together. There's more like double harmony guitars on it. It's a lot of that on that album, and I really love that as a guitarist. And yeah, I guess, you know, sometimes it's just it's hard to pick details from it, but it's cool that they have this theme throughout the album. I mean, I think lyric wise it's also like a red line through the whole album somehow. It's hard to tell. It's just a feeling, more like a feeling, you know. But I mean, I guess the guys had really fun doing this album as well on Bahamas.
Absolutely, and you're right. And it's funny because again, there's two like it's like a huge dramatic change of scenery, because as you said, the album was recorded in the Bahamas, which we'll talk about in a minute. But they actually rehearsed and wrote most of Power Slave in a hotel in Jersey, which is just kind of off the coast of the UK. So, you know, huge change in scenery. And I know recently, I don't know if anyone who's listening would kind of follow this at the time, but earlier this year, there's a Twitter account called Tim's Twitter Listening Party. And they, for their 666th listening party, they did Power Slave. And Iron Maiden kind of contributed comments to that. And Bruce said at the time in Jersey, he said, "We wrote this on Jersey, where we were holed up in January and February, freezing cold, Atlantic gales lashing the whole place. We were in a hotel, locked down, pretty much ourselves, except the bar was open and it was free, which was worrying." And for me, that just seems like more evidence, like you say, the fun they had making this album, how the band are really clicking, and then consequently how that comes across in the music as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of like fighting themes in the songs, but that's Maiden also, like throughout all the years, a lot of war theme and stuff like that. You know, do you call it fencing? Mm-hmm. The thing Bruce does.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's actually on point what you said. That was hard to describe. It's just a feeling, but you can really tell they had fun together, and you had to be a lineup for a while to really get to know each other and to enjoy each other's company and be relaxed and creative together, you know?
Exactly. And I mean, once in the Bahamas, as we've said, that's where they've recorded Power Slave. They reconvened with Martin Birch, who'd produced every Iron Maiden album since Killers up to this point. Now, he sadly passed away last year, Martin Birch, and Iron Maiden released a really nice statement paying tribute to him. And one of the things that it says in there, they said, "A man of many nicknames, simply one of the greatest people we've ever worked with. He was just absolutely brilliant. He wasn't just a producer, he was a hands-on engineer too, so he knew how to get a great sound. He was fantastic at motivating people. He just had a knack of getting the best out of you." I mean, obviously, like I say, this amazing run of albums, by my maths, if I work it out, Martin produced all of those with the exception of the debut. How important do you think that Martin's production is on Power Slave and those classic Iron Maiden albums?
I think a lot, definitely. Maiden wouldn't sound like Maiden without Bruce on vocals and, you know, whatever. But I know a producer does a lot, and Iron Maiden has a really classic and like legendary sound that only Iron Maiden has. I mean, there's a lot of band that has been trying to sound like them, but there's just something about their sound, and I guess he's a big guy behind that. And also, I mean, it's important to have a good producer. If you don't have that, it doesn't sound good. I mean, it's he becomes the fifth or sixth member in the band for those weeks where you record the album. He or she becomes a part of the album somehow. So it's super important. And so he's definitely a legend and a big loss to the world that he's gone now.
In a really weird coincidence, so a few weeks ago we interviewed Ian Haugland from Europe, and he chose Rainbow Rising as his album, which Martin also produced. And I'd said to him, very similar question to what I'd asked you, kind of what makes Martin such a great producer? Does he have any hallmarks, this kind of stuff? And at first he'd said that he's very good at stepping back and letting a band be, you know. But then he did comment on the drums, and he said that he feels that a Martin Birch album, there's a really good drum sound there. Is that something that you've noticed when you're listening to Martin Birch albums?
Yeah, I mean, the drums fit in really good. And, you know, I mean, I as a drummer, you always want the drums higher in the mix. But I guess it's just the piece you have. Like, it's a good balance of everything. And yeah, the drum sounds good, and the snare sound is great. And yeah, definitely. And I also agree on the thing that he takes a step back and let the band do their job, because I also think Iron Maiden is a kind of band that really needs to just be who they are in their songs. I mean, they don't all only have good songs, Iron Maiden. They have some really weird stuff too, but I mean, I guess they need to have that kind of songs as well to having fun and be productive and creative and everything. And that's important as well, you know, because otherwise you take away the fun from it. You need to do the things that get you motivated in the moment, basically. So, I mean, that's really a thing that's also important with a producer, to let the band be the band wanna be, you know.
And I think it's funny, again, in that Twitter listening party, anyone who got the liner notes for Power Slave might have noticed that Martin's credited as Martin Poolbully Birch, which I believe is the only album that's done on. And again, so they were asked about that, and Steve commented during the Twitter listening party about Martin. When he did get a day off, if we were out by the pool or whatever, he'd just walk past and push everyone in. So that's where the Pool Bully nickname in the credits came from. So it's like we're saying, it's like you said, that a good producer becomes almost kind of a fifth or a sixth member of the band, like just as integral as drums, bass, guitar, whatever's going on in that band.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, I can imagine they had fun. And yeah, I guess, you know, I don't know if you have that saying in English, but we say in Swedish, like a dear person has a lot of nicknames, but it sounds more catchy in Swedish. There's a lot of truth in that. That's just a proof of how much they really loved him and enjoyed working with him.
So I think a hugely important element of this album is the storytelling across all 8 tracks, and I think they've always been a band that can tell an amazing story, and there's no argument that tracks like The Trooper, Hallowed Be Thy Name from earlier albums are great examples of that. Metal Hammer argue that Power Slave's the album where the band's ability to tell stories rose to a new level. So we've talked about that maturity musically. Do you think that comes across lyrically too? Do you think that the stories are maybe a bit more?
Yeah, definitely. And also, like, I can just feel, I don't know how it is to play in Iron Maiden, but I mean, Steve Harris is the band founder, and he is writing a lot of the songs. And I can just imagine that it took some time for Bruce to that Steve would let him in to the songwriting, you know. I don't know this, but it's just my thoughts about it. And I think on this album, Bruce really got a chance to write some songs and lyrics. And I mean, Bruce is an amazing storyteller. You can just watch him on stage, like with his changing clothes, and you know, he's like this, you know, he's like a priest or whatever. It's like he's a teacher in a kindergarten. I don't know, but he's just all about that, and he's doing it so good. And I mean, these songs on this album, they are a lot about that, definitely. Now, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, with this long break, which is like, and then they moved out, you know. I mean, how many bands would actually dare to put a part like that into a song that way? You know, it's really cool.
And then get away with it as well.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
So outside of the production of this album, there's two things, at least for me, that immediately spring to mind when anyone discusses Power Slave. So one of them is the huge tour they went on to support it, which we'll talk about in a minute. The other is the album artwork from Derek Riggs, which, to be fair, I think when you're talking about Iron Maiden, you're talking about those album covers and the artwork. So let's talk about that first. So it's like I said, particularly Derek Riggs, his artwork on those classic Iron Maiden albums, that's almost integral as the music itself. In terms of Power Slave, do you think that's his best effort? Is that your favorite Iron Maiden cover, or do you think that there's another one that beats it?
I mean, it's so powerful. I mean, there's no doubt about that. You know, it's just a big pyramid with this Sphinx. Sphinx, you say that in English too?
Sphinx. Yeah, yeah.
it's just massive and awesome, you know. But it's actually not my favorite cover. My favorite one is Peace of Mind, actually. I have a tattoo of Peace of Mind on my back. So that's awesome. My favorite. But yeah, it's massive. And, you know, it's so cool how they always use the album cover as a theme for the tour that I guess we'll talk about soon. But and it's a really cool and nice theme, you know, Egyptian. Who thinks about that when you think about rock, you know?
Exactly. In an interview with Cyrus Amann, Riggs recalled designing the Power Slave cover. So he said, they told me we've got this Egyptian thing. We want Eddie as part of a pyramid or something. Steve Harris had this 18th century engraving of some guy dragging the head of Ramesses, and he thought he wanted Eddie's head on there. That was his idea. So copyrights are not even in this. So I sort of took the Egyptian idea. I started drawing. He goes on to say, it's quite a long quote. He went on to say that the final drawing was 32 inches by 33 inches. So there's no doubt when you look into it, and we'll talk about some of the details on the album, there's loads going on, which is hard to see if you've got it on like CD, for example. Even vinyl, there's probably some stuff that's quite difficult to find when he's done it 32 by 33.
Oh, that's super cool. It is genius when you think about it. Yeah, of course they needed to have Eddie on there, you know, on a big Sphinx. Why not? It's so... somehow I wish they were like real ones in Egypt that you could travel to and watch the big Eddie Sphinx. I would love that.
and then obviously that's the centerpiece, but then there's loads of cool little jokes and Easter eggs. I think there's a bit where it says like Indiana Jones was here 41 and all this kind of stuff. There's even,
it is on the cover,
apparently. So yeah, apparently it's hidden somewhere. There's like graffiti on some of the pyramids, and I think that one of them says either Jones or Indiana Jones was here 41. There's a really good article from Livewire that shows you all the little bits. There's even like the Mickey Mouse symbol somewhere that he's hidden. Definitely worth having a bit of a look and explore and trying to see what cool little things he's hidden in there. Because again, particularly on a CD, it's going to be really, really difficult to find.
I have the CD here and it's impossible. I can tell you. It's impossible. But that's really cool. Now I want to buy a big one and really have a look into it. That's really cool. Really cool.
And then, of course, as we've said, there was that world slavery to it. So this is where the phrase power slave takes on a whole new meaning, essentially. So the band play, and you'll know better than me how arduous this kind of tour would be, but they played 189 shows across 28 countries in 331 days, so in less than a year. An arduous tour by any standards, but some huge moments along the way. What kind of impact do you think that the World Slavery Tour had on the band? Obviously, this is arguably the moment they really broke through internationally.
I mean, a lot. I can just imagine. I mean, they were huge by then, you know? Must have been their, like, top. No, they're still on really top, but... I mean, they must have really felt that they were not a garage band anymore on that tour. When I think about it, I'm born in 89, so unfortunately I missed that one. I would have loved to see it. You know, my first Maiden album was actually Live After Death. I didn't realize it wasn't a live album because I thought it was a cool album name. When I was new into Iron Maiden by then, but... that was the first album I bought because it had Aces High, you know, the most important one. And then when I put it on back home, I was like, oh, it's live. But it didn't really matter to me because, I mean, they're a great live band. So, yeah. And they had all my favorite songs they played. It was amazing. So, from that on, my first, like, 2 years of Iron Maiden, as an Iron Maiden fan, I was just sitting in my childhood room playing guitar to the stereo because I was listening to the album and I learned every song by ear, you know, on my guitar. So, I mean, it's just great. It's my biggest, like, sorrow in life that I could not be there in person and see it with my own eyes and hear it with my own ears because... that was awesome.
And I mean, the thing with Iron Maiden is, and it's the success they've had, like you say, they're still today one of the biggest bands on the planet. Never really, certainly not in the UK and in America, certainly not had significant radio airplay, so they've done it all themselves. The World Slavery Tour, it marks some major milestones. So there were shows in Poland, Hungary and Yugoslavia. They marked the first time that a rock act had performed a full show in the Eastern Bloc. And of course, and this is the big one which always blows my mind, Iron Maiden supported Queen at the inaugural Rock and Rio Festival in Brazil in 1985 in front of over 350,000 people. Like, those kinds of numbers, and oh, it's just insane.
It's insane. I mean, especially now in Corona times, like, damn. I guess the World Slavery Tour really did make Maiden into a worldwide band somehow, you know. Again, I wish I were alive back then, but that must have been their big, like, I mean, they couldn't be bigger than that afterwards. They just continued to be as big as they were for the rest of their lives or something after that. But it must have been a lot of hard work for them, definitely. Jeez, it's a big tour and a lot of shows and everything. So, yeah, that's cool. But that's also something you need to do if you really want to, you know, take over the world, basically. So they did it and they made it. Yay.
I mean, the tour, it did take a huge physical toll on the band, particularly Bruce, who he told Mick Wall for the band's 2004 biography, Run of the Hills. He said, "I never thought it was going to end. I began to feel like I was a piece of machinery, like I was part of the lighting rig." And he did actually contemplate leaving the band during this time, but he ended up staying for a few more albums. Obviously, famously, he left in the 90s and then came back towards the end of that decade. Do you think that maybe the World Slavery Tour, do you think that was maybe the sowing of those seeds where Bruce decided that maybe leaving at some point might be something he needed to do?
I don't know, actually. I mean, of course, I can really imagine and understand that it was a tough tour. And I can imagine they were drinking and partying a lot, and that didn't make life easier when you have to perform so much. But my guess is, I mean, no, because he was still kind of new into the band, and I don't think he was that... I mean, Bruce is an amazing person. Like, he does so much stuff, and he feels like this kind of person that, you know, nothing is impossible. And I mean, he's flying jet planes, and he was a super good fence player. I don't know how you call it, but I mean, he's just this super person. So I have really a hard to imagine that he would give up that easily, if you know what I mean. My guess is it's more like he wanted to do his own kind of thing. Maybe Steve Harris was like, I guess he's deciding a lot in the band because it's his band after all. But and that Bruce just wanted to do his own thing. That's my guess why he left. But I have no idea, to be honest.
Yeah,
it's fun to read in the, you know, the last page where they have their thank yous and everything. They say, like, "See you on the World Slavery Tour." Whoa, you know, super excited. They didn't know what they were having in front of them when they released the album.
Absolutely. So before we go track by track, we'll dive in. I just can't help but think, and we've touched on this a bit already, just so a lot of the time when we're doing these kind of classic albums and classic bands, the bands are still big, but that star's waned a little bit. Do you know what I mean? They can maybe, like, living off sort of past glories, but certainly couldn't say that of Iron Maiden. They're probably as big now as they've ever been.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, I'm just thankful because, you know, I discovered them when I was 15 and I saw them live for the first time 2005 when they did the Early Days tour, when they played the first four albums. So I feel so lucky to have, like, a favorite band that actually still plays, you know, and still plays all the old hits. They never get tired of them. And, I mean, as a fan, that means so much. I mean, I have a few songs that I haven't heard live with them yet, but basically most of my favorite songs, I've heard them play them, and, you know, that just fills my heart and my soul so much. And, yeah, it's amazing. I don't understand where they get all the energy from, because they're not very young anymore. But I mean, they play the songs a little bit slower now. Like, I guess Nico is not really in the same, like, he can't play really the same tempo as he could in his younger days, but they still sound really good. It's crazy.
How much of the Iron Maiden that we know and love in 2021, how much of it would you say has its roots in the Power Slave era in terms of kind of where they are now and the kind of music they're producing and all of that stuff?
a lot. I mean, that's, for me, Power Slave is what Iron Maiden is about. And then, I mean, in when they released the Brave New World album, something had definitely happened with the band, like sound-wise. And I love all the most of the new songs as well, especially the Brave New World album is great. But they made something different then. I like the mix of both of them. But for me, I mean, the Power Slave era is... That's a major reason for me to listen to Iron Maiden. You know, the energy and the high vocals and the fast drums, the tempos, and you know, the two harmony guitars. I just love that so much.
So let's go track by track, and we'll kick in obviously with that one that's obviously really important in terms of your love of Iron Maiden, the opening track, Aces High. One of my favorite Iron Maiden tracks, as well, as it happens. I really... High octane start for Power Slave, one of their most loved songs, as I'm sure we've put across. In terms of, obviously, you've shared quite a lot your thoughts on the song. In terms of it kicking off this album, how does it kick off Power Slave for you?
I mean, it kicks off like it kicked my brain out the first time I heard this song. I mean, it's what a, and I mean, they opened up the whole World Slavery Tour with it, and it's just the perfect punch in the face opening song. I mean, Bruce's scream in the end of the song, jeez, you know, it's crazy. And I love that both Adrian Smith's and Dave Murray's guitar solos in there. And it has so many cool parts. I mean, it was one of the first Maiden songs I learned to play on guitar. And it still is one of my favorite songs to play on guitar, because, I mean, it's just great. It's just a punch in the face, so to say.
And I mean, the song's written, and we'll obviously, there's some great stories coming out of this album, as we touched on. The song's written from the perspective of a British RAF fighter pilot during the Battle of Britain in 1940. And I think the idea of being almost like in a war zone in the sky, that comes across so well, like you say, Bruce. And, you know, he has had that nickname of having a voice like an air raid siren, you know what I mean? And it's kind of, I think in this song more than ever, in the frantic pace of it, that Maiden gallop and all this stuff, again, it's not just the lyrics that tell the story, it's the music that tells the story too.
Yeah, I mean, the two harmony guitars in the intro and also in the end, it kind of feels like this, also planes with an alarm kind of thing. I don't know, I haven't been in a war song, thank God, but I can imagine, you know, they really have a talent to really capture a story with music as well, definitely, you know. It's so funny because... When I was 14, no, 15, I had to be 15, I guess. In ninth grade, we had like in history class, we talked about World War II. And I was like, why does Iron Maiden have Churchill's speech as a intro of their concert? And my teacher was like, yeah, I wonder why. And so then I actually did a project about just that, why Iron Maiden uses Churchill's speech in the beginning. And you know, I got the highest grade on that job because I got to use Iron Maiden for a history class, which was great, and I actually learned something about it. Iron Maiden teaches people and educates people as well, if you really dig into the lyrics. That's cool, I think.
Aces High was the opening song on many Maiden tours, but including the World Slavery Tour. I saw them on the Book of Souls tour, and I think that they opened with Aces High on that tour. Of course, with kind of, as you'd said, this iconic Churchill intro, you know, that we shall fight though on the hills, you know, how integral would you say, because again, obviously that speech, it is non-Power Slave, it is just kind of reserved for the live shows and the music video. How integral a part of that, like, do the two just go together for you now? Is it weird to hear Aces High without that intro?
Yeah, I guess so. Because I haven't heard it without the intro. And, you know, I don't remember if it was on the Book of Soul tour, but anyway, they opened up with Aces High recently, like just 3 years ago or something. And yeah, I cried because it was the first time I saw it live, and it was just, it meant a lot to me to hear it for real. And then they opened the stage, and it's this big plane on stage, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what model it was. You knew it.
I'm sure they had Spitfires flying over like Donington Park and stuff the last time they played there.
Yeah, but you know, it was so cool. I mean, I cried. I only cry when I see Maiden live. No, not only, but It's tears of joy, and somehow it makes me feel proud. I don't know why, but I get like proud feeling that makes me cry somehow, but it just goes straight into my heart. And I really, you know, I mean, it fits with the Aces High lyrics to have Churchill speak, because I mean, it's World War II, and yeah, UK had a main part of that war.
So, I mean, Bruce spoke to Vice about how challenging Aces High is to sing live, particularly, I think he said on the, it was on the Made in England World Tour, so that was 2012-14, where it was actually moved to the encore. So he'd said at the time, there's always at least one song in the set, which is an absolute motherfucker to sing, usually because of just where it is in the set. On the last tour, it was Aces High, because it's a difficult song to sing anyway. It's very vocally demanding, and of course, where do we put the song? In the encores right at the end of the show. So when you've been belting it out for the entire show, then you come back out and boom, Aces High. It's very vocally demanding.
Yeah. Poor guy. I like how he, you know, basically never sings the songs live as he sings on the album, because obviously he needs to save his voice so he can tour a lot, but he always finds like other ways to sing them. You know, something like that. So and he, like, now he's old. Nobody expects him to hit that big high note in the end, I guess.
So let's move on to 2 Minutes to Midnight. This was the first single released from Powerslave. For anyone who's wondering, Aces High was the second single. 2 Minutes to Midnight, written by Bruce and Adrian Smith, about the growing threat of nuclear war between the US and the Soviet Union at that time. And this has come up in the odd song we've talked about on My Classic Album in the past. And I guess you were saying you were born in 89, so I was born in 86. It's kind of difficult for us to comprehend, kind of over 30 years on, what that impending threat must have felt like to be living that and thinking, this is something that's very real and very possible. There's been very few times in our lifetime where that's felt like a distinct possibility.
Yeah, it's super hard to take in, definitely. I have nothing to say about that. Like, I haven't even been near to experience something horrible like that. So I just feel lucky. I love 2 Minutes to Midnight. And as a guitarist, that was like when I was buying a new amplifier when I was also 15. Like, you know, I went from not knowing about Maiden until becoming the biggest Maiden fan on the planet, basically. So I was going to buy a new guitar amplifier, and my main focus was to have an amplifier that could help me get the same sound as on 2 Minutes to Midnight, because that guitar riff with that sound, it was just, that was the, yeah, I just wanted to be able to sound like that.
So Adrian told Martin Popoff that it took him and Bruce only 20 minutes to write 2 Minutes to Midnight, which is just mind-blowing. So in the book 2 Minutes to Midnight and Iron Maiden Day by Day, Adrian explains, I was sitting in my hotel room in Jersey working on this riff. There was a banging on the door. It was Bruce, who immediately demanded to be let in on the action. So I played them the music to it, and he had a bunch of lyrics. He started singing, and we had 2 Minutes to Midnight. We wrote it in about 20 minutes. What are those flashes of inspiration? Like, have you ever had that kind of in your time with Thundermother, where like everything just falls together so quickly, and then you've got this song that's pretty much fully formed in such a short space of time?
I mean, yeah, definitely. The best songs are the easiest one to write. You know, when everything just falls into pieces and falls into place, you know, everything just clicks. The easy songs are the best ones, I think. So it doesn't really surprise me, but it's fun to hear the fact. It took 20 minutes. That's cool. But I mean, that must just have been like just the right moment. Everybody was in the right place and just, yeah, boom, there you have it. A classic, legendary rock song.
And I mean, for those who may not be aware, obviously we've touched on the subject matter a little bit already. The title 2 Minutes to Midnight is a reference to the Doomsday Clock. So the Doomsday Clock, for anyone who maybe doesn't know, was created in 1947 by the magazine Bulletin of Atomic Sciences. It was initially set at 7 minutes to midnight. And what it indicates is that due to the threat of nuclear war or other stuff, that the world was running out of time. So the clock has moved back or forward, depending on how imminent these guys believe the end of the world is, which is a really chilling thing. I checked while we were preparing for this. So Maiden was singing about 2 minutes to midnight in 1984, which I think is about what it was at the time. the current kind of doomsday clock says 100 seconds to midnight, which is a really, that's worse than what Iron Maiden was singing about. But it does seem, thinking about the Cold War and stuff, it did, and again, obviously, we weren't there, we're not exactly kind of experts on it, but it does seem from stuff I've read and that was a really scary time, and arguably we've got less time than that.
Yeah, but did they really, like, I don't think they really caught that storytelling in the video, though. It's weird. You know, there's a guy in the room and a clock on the wall. Like, I don't know. They always had, like, this kind of weird music videos, Iron Maiden. Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I always think about the Can I Play With Madness video. I always thought that was a really strange one. Yeah. That used to get played on the TV channels all the time over here. But I mean, maybe spurred on by that video, I don't know. But 2 Minutes to Midnight reached number 11 on the singles chart here in the UK. At the time, that was kind of one of the highest placings. As we've said, both the songs we've talked about so far were the singles chosen. What do you think makes them strong singles from the album? I mean, obviously, they've done well. There's a reason why they've picked them and why they've done so well.
Yeah, I mean, I think a very important thing is it's great guitar riffs. I mean, that's important, especially in Iron Maiden songs. That's what people expect when they hear a Maiden song. And I mean, the vocals are great. I mean, 2 Minutes to Midnight is a really catchy chorus. 2 Minutes to Midnight. I mean, everybody can sing along with that. So, I mean, yeah, it's both. They're both great songs, and I guess they were just in the right time to be released and to become huge, I guess. And it was in the right time for Maiden as well.
We're going to continue to go track by track with Emily Johansson, working our way through the phenomenal album Power Slave by Iron Maiden. I mean, it's like I said there in the interview and near the start, you know, I think Maiden's 80s run is perhaps unparalleled in metal. You know, I think it is the phenomenal albums, and it's really hard to single one out. You know, Power Slave might just inch it. You know, it's a great album, and we'll continue to talk about that album as we go track by track very shortly indeed. But one of my favourite parts of the show, where we get to kind of look to the future a little bit. So we spend all this time talking about these classic albums and looking to the past, and that's great. But when we get that opportunity to look at the present and the future and say that rock is very much in safe hands, that's always really cool, and it totally is in this instance. So here is a track from Thunder Mother's new album, Heatwave. It came out last year during the pandemic. They've released a deluxe edition back in May. Amazing tracks on there. Here's one of my favourites. This is Thunder Mother with Driving in Style.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to the instrumental track on the album. So this is Lost for Words, Big Aura. Actually holds the distinction of being the final instrumental track in their career. There's actually only four instrumental Iron Maiden tracks. What do you make of Lost for Words? And again, just for anyone who does want to kind of seek those other ones out, we've got Transylvania from their self-titled debut, and then we've got the Ides of March and Genghis Khan from Killers. So again, it's the only instrumental in the Bruce Dickinson era as well. What do you make of Lost for Words, and how does it rank against those other instrumentals I've just mentioned?
It's my favorite of the instrumental ones, definitely. And it's one of my top songs on the album. I mean, I love Bruce's voice, but I don't mind instrumental music. I really love that. I mean, I listen a lot to movie soundtracks and, you know, orchestral music. And it's just, I mean, there's also this really catchy guitar riff thing. And when I learned to play it, I was so proud. And I was like, yay, I can play this song. And I had a teacher in my school that was like, he was also a Maiden fan. So we used to jam that one together. So we learned one, you know, the solo that comes on after that part. It's a two harmony solo, and we played it together. And yeah, I just love that song very, very much. It's a great one.
And I know a lot of people, there's been a lot of questions over the years as to why it's an instrumental, you know what I mean? Because again, they're not a band hugely known for doing them. And Steve told Metal Hammer, he said, we just didn't have any words for it. But when we listened to the track, it seemed a shame to put words on it. The melody was so good. You never know, we might record one for the next album. We don't have any set rules. We just go with the flow. And even the title, and again, this might be something that's certainly in the UK, it's probably something that was picked up a bit more than other countries. Lost for Words is almost kind of, if you say that's almost how Iron Maiden would say the sentence Lost for Words. Yeah. So even the title is kind of a pun on the fact that it's an instrumental.
Yeah. And I mean, I agree. I don't miss the vocals on it. I hope Bruce wasn't sad when they choose to have this one on the album. I also think it's really brave to have it as a number three on an album. Random, but I mean, Maiden always does their own way, and somehow it works, as we already talked about. I mean, you would imagine it would have been like the last track, but it works somehow, you know. And I always love when that one comes on. Like, yeah, now it's that one, the good guitar. It's super catchy, right? I don't know what kind of vocals they would put on there. Sorry, all the vocalists in the world. We don't always do.
I think you're right, though. I mean, obviously, the first two tracks are amazing, but obviously, we've heard them a lot. They've appeared on Greatest Hits albums. They performed a lot live. I feel like once you get to this one, it's almost like you're settling into the album. This comes on, you're like, right, okay, I'm in it for the long haul now. Let's get stuck into this album. That's how I feel when this one comes on.
That's actually a good explanation.
Loudwire saved the track. Goofy title aside, this rambunctious instrumental from Powerslave is routinely dismissed as throwaway filler, but its place along the album's 52-minute timeline makes perfect sense, and the record would be unimaginable without it. I mean, would you agree with that? You've said it's one of your favourites. Like, if this was taken out, like, what would that effect would that have on the album?
No, it's one of my favourites, like, not on, just on the album. I love this song, and I don't even think I knew it was on Powerslave when I first started to love it, you know, because I had the live album. So it was so that one is on this album, basically. But it totally works to have an instrumental track just in the middle of it. Here we, you know, and that's really cool. They dare to do anything they want.
So our next track is Flash of the Blade. So one of two tracks on the album we've already touched on, inspired by Bruce's love of fencing. Flash of the Blade follows a young swordsman who learns his craft to avenge the death of his family. And I think, interestingly, in spite of that awesome riff, there's some really cool harmonies that I love on this track. Yeah. It's one that's never actually been performed live. I mean, what do you make of that? Why do you think it's maybe been left off the live shows?
I don't know. I mean, now I think it's just maybe too high for Bruce to sing. That could be a reason. And I mean, I wouldn't want to hear it without the in a corner, you know, that away, the loud, really high harmony there. But I don't know. I think it's a great song. I mean, that sounds like a single to me as well, you know, also with a great guitar riff in the beginning. And I remember I was so proud because you can play with just one finger, you know, diddle, 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 and just move it. So that, I mean, it's a cool guitar riff. I mean, all guitar riffs that are kind of easy to learn to play, that's a good riff, because, I mean, guitarists all over the world, you're just so proud when you learn to play something that you love, when you're learning an instrument of any kind, you know.
And I know you touched on there, you said you thought it might have been a good candidate for a single, and Loudwire kind of agreed with that. So they'd said, there's nowhere near enough swashbuckling in heavy metal these days, perhaps because Iron Maiden absolutely nailed the idea on Power Slave in 1984. A cult favourite among fans of a certain age, Flash of the Blade is a foot-to-the-floor tale of shiny weapons and swivel-eyed bravado that really should have been a single. We both really enjoyed the song, and you've said that you would agree with that. What do you think? Is it the stuff we've been talking about that makes it a strong single, like kind of the harmonies and the riff and all of that stuff?
Yeah, definitely. And then I just, like, I guess Aces High and 2 Minutes to Midnight are just a little stronger. And that's maybe the reason why it wasn't a single, basically. I mean, Because that would have worked too. It has this, all the classical Maiden stuff in there, you know? So definitely would have worked as a single.
Although it's a bit of a hidden gem, it's had a notable life outside of Power Slave. So there's a couple of places where it pops up. Flash of the Blade features on the soundtrack for the movie Phenomena. So that's also known as Creepers for anyone listening in the US, about a young girl who can communicate with insects. Now, I'd never heard of this film before doing my research for today, but I had a bit of a look through the soundtrack and it was a pretty interesting one. The film itself sounds a bit of an interesting watch as well. So again, anyone who's interested in that. There's also Avenged Sevenfold actually covered this for Flash of the Blade. They covered it for the 2008 Iron Maiden tribute album, Made in Heaven. Mm-hmm. Have you heard Avenged Sevenfold's take on the song? I thought it was quite faithful to the original and quite a good choice for Avenged Sevenfold in terms of their sound to choose that one.
Mm-hmm. I haven't listened to it. I mean, I guess I'm like, nobody does it as good as Maiden. You know, but I'll give it a shot after this. I will listen to it. I promise.
So let's move on to the Duelists. So from a song that appeared in a movie to one inspired by one, the Duelist was inspired by the 1977 Ridley Scott movie of the same name. And, you know, Maiden, they take a lot of inspiration from movies and TV shows. So I immediately think of the Prisoner from Number of the Beast immediately springs into my mind. I mean, is there a strength to that? So we've talked about it, kind of some of their songs educating us, but do you think sometimes there's a strength that perhaps if you haven't seen the source material, so I haven't seen the Duelists movie, but I still think it's a great song, but then someone who has seen the movie might appreciate this song on a whole other level.
Yeah, maybe, definitely. I mean, if people that watch it actually pays attention to the music, because that don't always happen, I guess, because you're so into the movie. Because I haven't seen it, you know, I don't know how it's put in to the story or whatever, you know, but I mean, that could definitely do stuff. I mean, that's how I discover a lot of music. I do, definitely. But I know a lot of other people do not pay attention to music as much as, you know, it's different. I'm not a big, like, I don't really listen to lyrics when I listen to music, because there's too much musically that goes into my ears. So the lyrics always like disappear somehow. They are also just like an instrument with sounds to me. But so I really have to read lyrics to really like, you know, we all listen to music differently, I guess.
And I know that the Duelist has another connection to the movie, Andy Bruce's love of fencing. So he, again, during Tim's Twitter party, Bruce revealed that the guy who choreographed the fights in the film, the Duelist, was a guy called Bill Hobbs. He founded a fencing club called the Swash and Buckle, where Bruce fenced. He said, a lovely guy who wrote a definitive book on stage fighting. He made the Duelists savage and brutal. And again, obviously, we've said, without seeing the film, we don't know how much kind of the lyrical stuff comes from the film and that. But I guess, you know, obviously, when Bruce is saying that, he's saying that Bill made the Duelists savage and brutal. But I guess in some ways, again, that brutality bleeds into the song too, not just lyrically, but musically, like we were talking about Aces High, the way that they can draw you into a story in a situation.
Mm. I mean, I guess the Duelist is the weakest track of the album for me, but it's still a good song. I mean, I re-listened to the album now before our meeting here, and I just realized that this is a really overall good album. And there all those little stories in there, and I'm just listening so excited when you talk about them, because I have read the lyrics but not really thought about them as you have, so it's really interesting to hear.
So we'll move on to Back in the Village. So for you, how does this fare? Again, I think sometimes in the age of streaming and CDs and stuff, sometimes it can be difficult to think that albums were designed in this way to kind of be almost kind of enjoyed in two acts, if you like. How does Back in the Village fare as the opener for our second half of Power Slave?
That's a really good question, because yeah, I'm an 89er, so I have not grown up with vinyl. I've only been listening to CD. But now you get me excited to actually really start listening to Iron Maiden on vinyl as well, because I never thought, I mean, we split up songs on our albums, of course, to get them on, yeah, they're two sides of a vinyl, but I never really thought about that. There's a bigger thought behind that, to actually have two acts, like you tell me now, and that's really cool, because especially with Iron Maiden and their storytelling. So this makes me really want to listen to it on vinyl to get like a new experience all over again. Exciting also. You never get tired of it somehow, because there's so many aspects and details in it. You can listen to it over and over again, basically. But what do you think about it then?
Again, it's that thing. I mean, like I say, I was only born a few years earlier than you, but I think this podcast, it kind of got me into kind of listening to vinyl. There's been a massive resurgence of it here in the UK in the last 5 years or so. And it is because obviously there's just that moment where kind of the side A finishes, you have that moment to let it sink in, you've then got to physically go and turn it over, and this is obviously for any album. So then it's kind of, yeah, it's about the impact that track, that, and again, in 84, there'll have been, vinyl will have probably been the primary medium that it'll be released on, there'll have been a lot of thought in terms of, right, this should open side two. And I think that's what I really like about it. I think it does pack a really nice punch in terms of doing that. Another track that potentially could have been a nice single.
Yeah, definitely, because that's what I thought about now as well. Like, this is also a kind of, Back in the Village is kind of a good opening song as well, because you come back to this excited, a little faster track, back in the village, you know, fast and quick somehow. So it's a good opening track for part two, definitely.
I mean, interestingly, I mentioned The Prisoner from Number of the Beast a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. and that was inspired by a TV series that was on around the time. Back in the Village is also inspired by the same show. Do you feel like, you know, obviously knowing that now, if we were to play The Prisoner and Back in the Village together, do you think that they would sit nicely together as kind of companion songs, or do they feel very different?
Yeah, now I kind of get it. Like, so the Prisoner would come first, and then he is back, I guess, from prison in the village somehow.
Yeah, so there was another connection to the Number of the Beast album that's present on Back in the Village. So when Bruce sings the line, "I see sixes all the way," you can also hear this whisper of 666, which of course mm-hmm. is a cheeky nod to the title track, and some of the hysteria that, not just coming from that release, but a lot of kind of metal albums in the 80s, people worried about kind of backmasking and hidden messages and Satanism and all of that kind of stuff. So again, I wonder if that was maybe a reason why they chose not to release it as a single, to kind of avoid some of that backlash.
Maybe, yeah. Who knows?
Do you think it's an underrated song in the back catalogue of Iron Maiden?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Flesh of the Blade, I think it's my number one single that didn't become a single on the album. But this is also really good. Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to hear the whole album live, you know. I guess you always want to hear everything live, you know. But yeah. It's also, I mean, comparing to, I mean, songs that sound similar to that one, I guess they have better songs, and that's maybe just the reason why it's a little bit in the background somehow.
And then, of course, we've got these two epic tracks on the back end of the album. So we've reached the awesome title track now. Yeah. So written by Bruce, Power Slave, of course. The band must have liked this one too, because not only is it chosen as the title track, it informs that whole Egyptian theme on the artwork and the World Slavery Tour. What are your thoughts on Power Slave? Why do you think it was chosen as the title track for this album?
I mean, first of all, it is a it's a really good name. It's a really good name. I mean, it comes with all the Egyptian. It's really cool that they have this guitar riff that is kind of Egyptian in the sound, you know. I really like that. I guess it was just like, I have no idea. I mean, when we picked the name Heatwave for our album, it was basically because we were like, what kind of songs do we have on the album that has good names? And everybody was like, Heatwave is a really good name. Yeah, let's have that. And, you know, maybe that was the reason Maiden picked Powerslave too, because it's a really cool name. But I don't know. I have no idea. It's turned out great.
And I know song facts explain that this song is about an arrogant pharaoh in his dying hours. He's been raised to think he's a god and he can't understand why he's about to die and fights it in vain. And I think this is a great example. I've read a few things where people talk about what a visual album this is. And it's, you know, you're looking at that album artwork, you're listening to the song, you almost can't help but imagine Eddie, you know, as the pharaoh in his final moments. Like, it really just builds, as all these songs do, builds this really huge picture in your mind of kind of what Bruce is singing about and what the band are playing about.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But I'm more imagining Eddie as a mummy in this one. I guess that's where the mummy Eddie comes out on stage when they play it live. At least on the tours. But yeah, maybe. But I mean, that's so cool with Iron Maiden. They always make you put little stories in your head, all different stories, depending on who is listening. And that's kind of cool to compare what everybody thinks about it.
Yeah. I mean, Ultimate Classic Rock say the title track, they say an album as imposing and magnificent as Power Slave demands an equally commanding and majestic title track, and Iron Maiden deliver here. Dickinson's fascination with ancient Egyptian religion and tradition is the main subject, but the band brings a suitably morbid and metal interpretation to the tomb as they muse metallic on an entire civilization developed around the cult of death. And you know what it is, as subject matters go, that is pretty metal in some ways, like, to kind of think about what the song's about. Although I imagine there's not many people writing about it, it does feel like a really kind of metal subject to sing about, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great song. I love it.
And it's interesting when you talk about that kind of sort of Egyptian Middle Eastern influence. And, you know, it's something that Music Times said it isn't a well that metal bands dip into often enough. And they touch on Soundgarden using it a little bit on Super Unknown, Death using it on occasion as well. But that it was Iron Maiden who incorporated it brilliantly onto the title track. Do you think it is just kind of that Middle Eastern kind of vibe? Is there other stuff that they're doing that kind of conjures up that, again, that kind of Egyptian picture that kind of comes into our mind along with the album cover?
I mean, obviously, kind of the lyrics, the thing you told about, I don't want to die, I want to live. And that's what Egyptians believed in, basically, that if you mummified everybody, they lived on in the next life. And I mean, it must have been so fresh when they came with this. I can just imagine, like, no rock band, like mainstream big. I guess they were kind of mainstream, right?
Yeah.
Or is that just my imagination? But they must have been early with that. I haven't seen any other bands doing the Egyptian thing before they did. Or
no.
Am I wrong? No, I don't think so. Cool.
And it's funny, as I was researching this one, I read a lot of online discussion, and I must confess I haven't had time to go back and check this and see how much I agree with it. But obviously in the late 90s, American band Creed, who in some ways I couldn't think of a different band than Iron Maiden than Creed. But obviously they had a huge success in the late 90s. And a lot of people online are saying that they ripped the riff for Power Slave off slightly with one of their big singles, Higher. Something I know both songs very well, but I've never made that connection. I'm going to have a listen back and see if I agree. Have you noticed that? Is there, you know, has Power Slave been ripped off slightly on the riff for Higher, or is that something you'd have to go back and listen to as well?
I have to go back and listen to it as well. I mean, I've heard the song, but I haven't really listened to that band. I can't really
speak to
it, but I'm definitely going to look into that.
were Creed particularly big in Sweden? I mean, they were massive, particularly in America, but they were pretty big over here in the UK, and like, about 20 years ago, like late 90s, early noughties, Creed were like,
I mean,
massive.
I guess their biggest hits were on radio, but I mean, I haven't really been a radio listener. I've been like buying my CDs and I've been listening to them basically. I've when I find music I like, then I'm kind of happy with that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not often that I'm like, I want to find a new band now to listen to. Mm-hmm. That happens sometimes. Like, oh, I like this band, if it suddenly comes into my area somehow. But mostly I'm happy with the bands I have and I like, and I just enjoy that by myself somehow. So I'm not, but I guess they were kind of big in Sweden as well, I can imagine. Yeah.
So let's move on to Rime of the Ancient Mariner, clocking in at close to 14 minutes. For a good 30 years, it was the longest song in their back catalogue until Empire of the Clouds was released on the Book of Souls in 2015. Before we dive into this one a bit more, what are your thoughts on Rime of the Ancient Mariner?
I mean, I love it. And it's, for me, it's kind of two songs in one. Do you know what I mean? Because there's one song in the beginning, and then there's this like part in the middle where somebody is just talking. It's like super long. And then there's a new song somehow. And so it's two songs for me, and I like them both. But I've always been a little, as I told you, I don't really listen to lyrics. So that middle part, I always felt like it was boring somehow. It was just a thing. I was just like waiting for the part two to begin, basically. And but thank God part two was also good, because I think otherwise I would have maybe turned the song off after the first part. But that makes me listen through the talking stuff as well, you know. But it's, yeah, it was brave of them to do it. And yeah, somehow they get away with it. Somehow they get away with all the funny stuff they come up with. But yeah, I usually zoom out when the middle part comes.
So written by Steve, the song is inspired, and again, when we're talking about kind of metal educating and teaching us stuff, so it's inspired by the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, actually incorporates some lines from the poem in the lyrics. Adrian Smith told Metal Hammer, "We had this system whereby we'd each come up with our ideas, work with whoever to fill them out. Like, I would often work with Bruce on lyrics to my songs, or Davey on harmonies and guitar parts. Steve usually works on his ideas alone, and when they're kind of 90% done, he'll present them to the band. That presentation was always at the end of the day in the main communal area, like a show and tell at school. But when he put Mariner forward, I just knew we had to do it, because I'd never heard anything like it before." So at this point, you know, they're five albums into their career. Is this a major departure from what they've done on those previous five albums? Previous four albums, rather.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good song. What can I say? You always get happy when it starts. And I mean, yeah, I don't think it could have been on any other position on the album than the last track, you know. It's a good, like, ending of the album. It's a good ending of a great album, especially when the second part comes. You know, and our starts to build up again.
And I think as well, you know, when we've touched on this a few times, and I know we recently did Moving Pictures by Rush. So again, Neil Peart often has these like weird and wonderful kind of reasons for writing songs, like influenced by, you know, Tom Sawyer, or, you know, a poem he read or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's funny, like, I mean, my parents obviously really encouraged my love of hard rock and metal, but you do get so many people, particularly probably when Maiden were at this point in the 80s, who probably had parents being like, "What are you listening to this rubbish for?" Not realizing, you know, how many kids do you think were probably kind of digging in and thinking, "Oh, right, well, Steve's written a song inspired by this poem," and then digging the poem out and reading it and learning about it. Or again, Aces High, research and learning about the Battle of Britain, you know, because it's a song that Iron Maiden did.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess a lot of parents has been like nervous throughout the years that Maiden are like Satanists and the devil, blah blah blah, but it's all storytelling. That's just what it is.
And I think in the same interview that obviously they were talking about Steve's process, Steve himself reflected on the 13 minute runtime of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. He says, "The funny thing is, no one actually thought it was 13 minutes long at all. We were all so into making it work, and we all enjoyed it so much that we thought it was only 8 or 9 minutes long maximum. Mm-hmm. When Martin timed it at 13 minutes, we were all like, fucking hell, 13 minutes. And when we play it live, it never seems like 13 minutes at all. I'm trying to think if I've heard them play it live. I'm not 100%. I don't feel like it's a 13-minute song. I know you think that maybe there's to an extent that middle section drags? Does it feel like 13 minutes for you, or does it feel a bit more compact?
More like 8 or 9, I guess, because, I mean, but he is talking a lot in the middle. Like, that's long. And it's also like, before he even starts to talk, it's just a long part with just the bass and the guitar echo kind of thing. But I mean, live, I think it would feel way shorter live. Did they play it live? They must have played it live. It's more fun to watch them live with any... I mean, they have other songs with some weird storytelling in them as well, and they are a lot funnier live, because then you watch Bruce, and he's... I mean, you can really see him enjoy that, and you can hear him enjoy it on the rhyme part. Like, you can almost see him wearing this storytelling cap or whatever, just... going totally into that, just telling. Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't matter if it's 9 or 14, I guess. I guess it does matter if you have to fit all the songs on a vinyl. Otherwise, I guess it's fine.
It's like I think it's like 13 minutes, 30-something. It's like nearly 14.
Okay, yeah, that's a lot. But somehow that all also works really good for them. They get away with everything.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, kind of in 2021, as we're talking, you know, they really have embraced in that second half of their career, like you'd said, kind of Old Maiden and New Maiden, kind of near the start of our chat. Mm. They've really like embraced this kind of sprawling progressive metal sound. Mm. I mean, Kerrang note that Mariner's multi-part complexity set the tone for a direction the band would increasingly explore in later years. Do you think this song does seem like the starting point of that evolution? You know, again, they are a much more kind of progressive band than maybe they were in the Power Slave era. Do you think that Rime of the Ancient Mariner is maybe the start of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I could definitely see the rhyme being on, for example, the Book of Souls. Mm-hmm. Fit on that album. Maybe also Dance of Death. I mean, because that's in their latest stuff, they have a lot of more of these weird parts in the music where there's like voices talking and stuff like that. So yeah, that could definitely have been the start for that special thing.
I mean, I know you'd said for you, it feels like the only place you could put this is at the end of the album. How does Rime of the Ancient Mariner end Power Slave for you?
It does really good, because the second part is great. It's a good lift, and there's a lot of great instrumental parts in that song throughout the song, and it just makes you want to play along with them, you know. And it's a happy song, and that's always nice to end an album with a happy, you know, party vibe song somehow, you know.
So I mean, as an album, it's a career highlight in the midst of an incredible run of albums from Iron Maiden throughout the 80s. Arguably, as we've talked about and hopefully got across, it's still that measuring stick for a band who are as influential and vital as they've always been. And I mean, I've touched on this article a few times, a really good article to read about the album. Metal Hammer sum up how important Power Slave is in Iron Maiden's career. So they'd said, in many ways, Power Slave marked the end of a chapter for Maiden. Their next album, Somewhere in Time, scaled back the grandiosity slightly, bringing sequences and guitar synths into the mix, yet it also pointed the way forward too. 1988's conceptual Seventh Son of a Seventh Son brought the prog metal undercurrent that swam beneath Rime of the Ancient Mariner to the surface, an approach they've doubled down on for their most recent albums. Today, Power Slave remains the album of choice for many Maiden connoisseurs. In subsequent years, they've matched its grandiosity, but they've rarely bettered it. With that in mind, why has Power Slave stood the test of time, would you say?
I mean, because this album, they started to try new stuff and to get kind of outside their box, but there were still a lot inside their box. And I guess it's good to get outside the box, but I think for the main public, the main people, inside the box is more comfortable and easy to melt when you listen to it, you know. So maybe that's one part of it. But I mean, when you read all about this now, where, you know, I mean, Somewhere in Time is more that way, and Seventh Son is more that. I mean, it just makes me think, like, Maiden never stopped to develop themselves and try new stuff and go different ways, but somehow they still managed to keep it as much inside the box to to keep their fans, basically. I don't know, but that's really cool. You know, there's something in Maiden for everyone. That's what I think.
Yeah. And finally, why is Power Slave your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
It's a great album with great songs and good riffs and good choruses. You know, it's a lot of songs that you can, that get stuck in your brain that you can sing along with. And it sounds really good. And for me, it was the opening for what I am. I mean, it was the beginning to what I am today, basically, because when I started listening to Iron Maiden, a lot of things happened in me. It made me start dreaming and made me start to really focus on my guitar playing, which later turned into drumming. But, you know, their music made me feel so happy about playing rock and everything, and to watch them live with their energy and just, you know, it's just all about it. And I think just Power Slave is a great album to that really sums it all up, what Iron Maiden is. It's a lot of energy, it's a lot of guitars, great guitars and good drumming, fast songs, and yeah, it just has everything. It doesn't have ballads though, but Maiden is not really a ballad band, so their excuse. It was so cool, like I was outside of the Compass Point Studios in Bahamas because we were playing on the Kiss cruise and we did a stop on Bahamas and we went to the Compass Point Studios because AC/DC had recorded Back in Black. And then somebody told me, because I was wearing a Maiden shirt, he was like, "Do you know Iron Maiden recorded Power Slave here?" And I was like, "You fucking kidding me?" You know, I just took my shoes off because I was like, I'm walking on holy ground. I need to walk barefoot. Like, that was just huge, you know, it was really cool.
Yeah, well, Emily, thanks so much for coming on and chatting about Power Slave. I think it's about time we did an Iron Maiden album, and it was a great one to start with.
It was super nice to actually, you know, dig really deep into an Iron Maiden album and get really nerdy together with someone. Learned a lot, so thank you.
Yeah, awesome. I know, obviously, you talked a little bit about Heatwave. That came out the back end of May, didn't it? So what can people expect from this album if they want to pick it up?
Yeah, we released it last year, and then we did a re-release now in May, like a special edition with a bonus CD with 10 unreleased songs on it. You can expect like classic nice rock with an AC/DC core, but also like just inspired by a lot of 70s band and just nice, good, easy rock and roll, you know, less is more kind of rock. So if you like stuff like that, you should check us out.
And if that doesn't whet your appetite for new Maiden, I don't know what will. You know, talking about one of their greatest albums as we're just kind of on the precipice of a new Iron Maiden album. So, you know, I love it when things like that come together. Thank you very much to Emily Hansen for joining me to chat all about Power Slave. It's a great album. You know, you can absolutely just see not only that classic 80s Maiden sound, but some of that direction of where they were going and what we're going to hear on a new album, like Senjutsu, for example. So really, you know, I'm chomping at the bit to hear the new Iron Maiden albums. I'm sure everyone can probably tell, but you know, Power Slave as well, you know, I'll certainly be playing that quite a lot in the run-up to the new release. And that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me. Coming up in a couple of weeks' time, it's probably one of my favourite episodes we've done. Ron Bumblefoot Thal, who has played with the likes of Sons of Apollo, Guns N' Roses, currently playing with Asia too. He joins me to chat all about Yes's phenomenal Going for the One. And if you want to hear what it's like to deliver podcast links while having very, very hot sauce, Bumblefucked to be precise, you know, this is the episode to check out, absolutely. So join me in a couple of weeks for that. Thank you very much for joining me today, and I'll see you soon. Cheers.